I can do
Mike,
it.
What is wrong?
you can do it. Okay. Go ahead.
God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and wisdom to know the difference. Thank you. Zeus in New York.
Thank you. Thank you, Zeus. All right. Well, I think Kent and Debbie can very much tell you about who they are and how they feel about love and what that all entails to them. And I'm going to let Kent and Debbie tell you themselves. Kent and Debbie from Concord, California North.
Hi, Yvonne. Thank you so much. I am Debbie, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Kent, and I'm an alcoholic.
And what a great topic for this great weekend. Yvonne, did you want us to maybe, I know we have an hour, but did you want us to sort of stop early for Q&A or?
It's whatever you want to do. It's your hour.
Okay. Okay, great. Well, we were kind of talking about how we wanted to go about it. And so Kent is going to kick us off and I'm just going to follow the lead on that. Or take over, one of the two. You know how that works out. So take it away, Kent.
So in the end, I have figured out the way to a successful marriage is always have the last word. Providing the last word is, yes, dear. So I got that straight, finally. But my history with love or relationships or whatever, it started out exploring the possibilities of youth and taking advantage of every hormone I had and doing all those things, chasing after what young guys chase after. And I had absolutely no clue about having a relationship. Somewhere along the line, I got the idea that more was better. I don't know how I got started on that path. And after way too many, I realized that was not a successful way of living. It was always an emptiness chasing after something new. I went off to college, and got married in my early 20s to a redhead who had a wonderful way with words. That was a www before there was a World Wide Web. But anyway, she was impossible for me to deal with, and I divorced her within the year. And so I kind of had a pretty good idea. I was not marriage material. But I found, loneliness and so on. I ran across a broken spirit, and I thought, I'll resurrect and save this one. She is just in need of someone helping her and saving her. And I found out that's a task beyond my ability. And I wish her well. I had two children with her. And we never did connect. I don't know how we ever got married, but we did. And we had two children. I were twins. So it was a short, anyway, it was an interesting, but clearly unsuccessful relationship in any way. And I had no idea what to do. But that was back in my drinking and using period. And what I was really doing was what a lot of people do. And that was what I thought was the best thing to do. And I wasn't going to tell anybody anything else. I had all the answers. I didn't have any questions. And so that ended. And I call those my trainer marriages. But they were painful in divorce, very painful. So painful that went on. Incredibly painful. It was devastating because I was so close to my two children and it fractured that relationship. And my whole family life, I came from a family of loving parents and a close-knit family group. So that was a challenge I didn't want to face, but had to. And so that when that ended, I made this, I swore off getting married again until I got sober. Well, I didn't really get sober. I got online before I got sober. And you know how it goes. I went into one of those chat rooms and I, you know, she was cute. And so I started chatting with her and it was great, you know. I had just been pulled off the street from my best friend, John Bird. I mean, I really was taken from under a bush and put into his back bedroom, and I connected to a computer, to an online chat. And man, I was first sober. I wasn't the last time I got sober, but I had just gotten sober. And so she asked me what I did for a living, and I told her, and so she figured out that I was kind of attractive, and we had exchanged pictures from, she lived in New Orleans, I lived in California. I thought it was great. And from that distance, I looked real good too. And so she kept coming up with this thing that she wanted to get married. And I'm thinking, not if you've had my experience, there's no way I'm ever going to get married again. She just kept hammering me. She'd come up with one more, she had another question about, well, why don't we get married? And I tell her some cockamamie reason why not, and she'd solve that problem. And after about a year and a half of, you know, fending her off, finally, I just ran out of excuses, I guess. I don't know, or she wore me down. I don't know what happened, but I was not interested. I did not want to get married, and she talked me into it. And so I got married in December of 1987, and I got sober 8/8/88. So you can tell there was this period of time where actually she invited me to New Orleans, and I was to meet all of her friends. She was in a choral group. She was an accomplished singer. She was a lot of wonderful things. And when she introduced me, she had to bring them into the bedroom because, see, I had the only thing that was in the house was that, what was that red liqueur? What was that called? Some kind of a schnapps or something like that. Anyway, it was red, and I puked it all over the bathroom window. And so she would bring her friends in because I was on the bed, passed out, and that's how she introduced me to her friends. So it was not a match made in heaven, I can tell you. Well, it was. You know, the funny part about that was I had no interest in doing that marriage. And yet, and that's the characteristics of my successful marriages, by the way, because I wasn't interested. But God had bigger plans for me. I had no interest in God. And yet God knew this kid, if he was going to get sober, he was going to have somebody like her. And so when I got married in December of 87, I invited all my family and friends to New Orleans. No one showed up. No one. No one from my family, none of my friends. They didn't think it would last. I didn't either. But I was broken by alcohol. I was beaten to death, or nearly to death, by alcohol. And because I was so badly broken, when I got to AA, I knew my way wasn't going to work. I had to find some way other than Kent's way if I was going to be a success. And so with that little tidbit of surrender, I had two great blessings. One was a guy named Glenn Loist. Glenn was, he intimidated me. He became my sponsor. I did enough of what he said because I was broken. But also, I listened to that woman and did what she told me to do. I mean, there were things that I still believe in today. She said, she would say, let's go shopping. Well, men probably as a rule are not that thrilled about going grocery shopping. It's just not high on our list. When we get to the store, it's okay, you take that half, I'll take this half, and we'll get it done effectively. And she said, oh no, we're gonna walk the aisles. Oh, okay, but I did it. Then we also had a membership at Sam's Club and Costco. So the deal was on Friday night, say, honey, how about a little bit of exercise and a bite to eat, which was code for, because we were so broke, we'd walk the aisles of Costco and Sam's Club, and that would be how I'd take her out to dinner. But in even to this day, that kind of behavior, what she arranged, was to manufacture an opportunity for people, for a couple to be together, have a quasi objective, be public, and yet still be able to communicate with each other about what was going on. It was like a Safeway to talk. We have Safeway in this area. So we would go to the Safeway and we walk the aisles and we chit chat about what was going on in our lives and what we needed to talk about. And it really was a key ingredient in what I had to learn about how do you have a relationship. You spend time with somebody. She made it necessary. There was one time I was about 2.5 years sober and I was involved in this conference and I was going to the conference. And I called her up and she said, what are you going to do? You're going to spend the whole weekend at the conference? And I said, well, I've been on the committee, of course. And she said, oh my God. And she was so upset that I would spend so much time with AA. She was not in AA. She just wanted to spend time with me. So I called Glenn and I tell Glenn, oh my God, Glenn, she won't let me go to the conference. What do I do? And he said, well, maybe you should think about what it is that you need to do to stay sober and then figure out how to do it. Take responsibility and do what you need to do. Well, being brilliant as I think I am, I knew what that really meant was to go home and ask Skeeter. So here's what I've got these commitments. I go to these meetings. How much of the rest of the week do you want? And she said, I'll take it all. It was like, whoa, I wasn't ready for that one. But the outcome was we had a negotiated deal. No longer did she complain about every single commitment and every meeting I went to. She really felt that I loved AA and the people in AA more than I loved her because I put it first. And but I did learn that that if I listened to what she had to say and how she did things, that I got an idea on how to have a successful relationship. For 12 years, we got along famously. It was just incredible. She died of cancer in 1999. And I swear to God, I wanted to die and go be with her. You know, it was just, that was the only good life I had ever known. It was the only relationship I'd had over a month, I think. But I don't know, three months. Come on, be serious. But it was great. It was, I can remember guys talking about, I got to go home to my wife. And I always thought, oh my God, I get to go home to my wife. And so it was this successful way of life because I followed her direction. I did what she told me to do, basically. I did what Glenn told me to do in AA, and I got successful in AA. I got successful in a relationship. Trouble was in 1999, cancer, which is devastating, took her life, and And that was a tough time, because at that time, thank God I was as involved in AA as I was. If I had not had the commitments I had, just a little aside there, she died on Tuesday. And the week before that, Wednesday was my home group. And I said to her, it's Wednesday. And she said, oh, yeah, it's your home group, isn't it? And I said, yeah, it is. And she said, I understand why you have to go. And it was like, that's the only meeting out of those 12 years that she ever thought was important that I went to. And it was like, oh my gosh, I finally got it. Well, then she died the next week. She died on Tuesday, and I'm supposed to go to my home group on Wednesday, and the guy that sponsored me, Glenn, expected me to show up at a meeting, and I'm like falling apart. And I'm crying all the time. I have no clue what's going on. I'm just like, I've lost it, because the only thing that was really on my doorstep of any significance was that I would lose her. And now I've had the most important thing on my doorstep come true, and I don't know how to live. And so Glenn says, you going to the meeting? I said, no, I can't. He said, yes, you are. I said, there's no way I can make it to the meeting. He said, well, you're not going there for you. You're going there for your sponsees. You're going to show them that this program works. I don't know how he manipulated me in such a wonderful way. But I went to the meeting and balled my way through it, of course, and thought I was just a basket case. But whatever, it was AA that made it possible for me to make it through that. Well, Glenn had wanted me to get involved with somebody else, and he kept saying, who you're interested in. Oh my God, there's a man who's never had a successful relationship in his life, and he's trying to tell me I got to get involved and interested in somebody else. And I'm like, absolutely, Jesus. Lay off, just lighten up, give me a break, you know? But he wouldn't. And so somehow we end up, the two of us, going to a conference in Chicago, and he says, so who's interesting and who's cute, you know? And I saw a flyer there of a gal who was doing a sponsorship workshop. She had 12 years sober, it said. And I said, I'm interested in her. I had no idea who it was. And he said, good, we'll go to the workshop. And we went to the workshop, and of course he introduced me to her and wanted me to get her number. And oh my God, it was just pressure that I couldn't bear, but I got her email address finally, and she goes down to a conference in New Orleans. The same weekend I'm going to a conference in New Orleans for a memorial service. And I show up at the conference, and she shows up at the conference. I look at her, she looks at me, and we both had the same idea. We are not interested in each other. It was wonderful. I loved it. Well, her sponsor came to that conference, and but her sponsor was there with her boyfriend. But I knew her sponsor because she used to be married to my sponsor's sponsor. Anyway, I had fun at that because there's no pressure on me, and Glenn wasn't around either. But when I got back, you know, Glenn's trying to get me to get involved, and finally it was the week before I went to that I was going to the Saturday night Danville speaker meeting, and I told Glenn I'd been working all day and I couldn't go to the conference, and Glenn says to me, oh, good. This will give you time then to write that letter of goodbye to Skeeter. And I thought, you lousy son of a gun. You know, you nailed me. He said, he asked me if I had anything to do, and I said, no. He said, oh, good. Then you can write the letter. He played it right. He knew exactly how to do it. Anyway, I wrote this letter, and of goodbye to Skeeter. And it was 6 months, just 6 months after she had passed. Well, the funny thing is that sponsor of the girl that was in New Orleans, she was supposed to send me an email telling me about some guy who, I had a history workshop at the time, and I needed somebody to talk about the history of concepts. And so she was going to send me the guy's information. And she sends me the email that says, oh, and here's his information. And by the way, the disparaging part of that weekend is that Mike and I broke up. And I made the mistake of reading it to my sponsor. And he said, well, ask her out. I said, no. And he said, you know how it goes. I mean, as much as I fought against what he said, I typically did. By that time, I ended up doing whatever he told me to do, because I had, an experience where I really had listened to him enough to know that when I took his advice, it never got worse, right? But it really did. You start taking a sponsor's suggestion and doing it the way they tell you to do it, your life is going to get better. It's like weird. But there was this one time he got me so angry. He lied about me. Well, that's how I thought it. Anyway, we were at my home group meeting and he was talking about, I kept hearing these guys that I sponsor come up to me and say, hey, what's this I hear about you leaving your sponsor at the airport? And wait a minute, I never left my sponsor at the airport. And finally the last guy said, who is it that's telling you that? And he said, your sponsor. Oh, that's not true. Before he got on the plane, he asked me, could I pick him up at Oakland Airport? I said, sure. But after he got on the airplane, I found out that Steve L was going to be at the airport at the same time he was. Not only that, but that little blonde was available to me that I could spend some time with instead of going to the airport. And I had it all covered, right? Steve was going to be landing about the same time Glenn was. He could take him. Well, it took me weeks of being awfully angry, but I was so angry, I'm going to prove that my sponsor had to have given me some kind of advice that didn't work out well. And I was going to research every bit of 12 years of the sponsorship and figure out what it was. And I couldn't find even a single thing. Well, my experience with listening to what Skeeter had to say and listening to what my sponsor had to say, turns out that I ended up asking that woman if she's available. I spent some time. She asked me, well, how about coming down for the weekend? And I said, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, time's up. Sorry. Oh.
That's what's left. And I haven't talked yet.
Oh, okay. So I really met Debbie, and 6 months after Skeeter had died, I was not ready to get married. I had no interest. I'm still connected to Skeeter. I have no desire to be with anybody. And yet God's got a better plan for me, and he's going to tell me that you got to be with this woman. That I can remember in IHOP, I was sitting there absolutely bat crazy and just, oh my God. And I had this thought, it was like, Kent, are you going to be with this woman like God wants you to be, wants for you? Or are you going to do it your way? And it's like, you're kidding. I'm supposed to be with, I'm not ready. I don't want it. And so my suggestion to those people who are getting into a relationship, I think probably the best thing to do is let God bring you together. he did well by me in two different instances. I've had two great marriages, two trainer marriages and two great marriages. Of course, both of the good ones were sober, but I do believe that God put me with this person. It wasn't like I set out to find Skeeter and marry her, or I set out to find Debbie and marry her. It was like, no, God had a better plan than I did, and I followed his advice, and here I am coming up on 20 years in April. We'll be together 20 years, so thank God for a program called Alcoholics Anonymous and a willingness to do life somebody else's way. Thank you.
Thank you, Kent. So in learning how to have a decent relationship, I had a lot of experience having not so good ones. It would not have mattered what my examples were ahead of me, but it, because I would have still done exactly what I was going to do. I got sober at 18. I just celebrated 45 years on Monday, February 8, 1976 is my sobriety birthday. And my drinking years and my early sober years were all about just fun. And I didn't have any depth or weight to any relationship. They were all about immediate needs and fun. And nothing lasted longer than 3 months either. My first marriage, I was 29 years old. I got married. I thought, we love each other and we love AA. That should be enough. And I mean, I had zero clue on how to be in a relationship, how to be a partner, how to be collaborative, because all I brought to the table was self. Well, that doesn't have a lot of mileage to it. It's pretty shallow. And after 5 years and 9 months of that marriage, it would come to an end. And one of the things that I learned is that it's not about pointing fingers at them, because there really are three pointing back at me. And I had to take my own inventory, and I realized how I don't really know how to be in a relationship. I don't know how to be a partner. I don't know how to collaborate. And that, okay, God, if you do have anybody out there for me, okay, but I needed to be educated, learn how to do things differently. So I read a couple of helpful books for me. I mean, there are gajillions of self-help books and relationships and you name it, little detours and sidelines off of that. And you can have plenty of those. But the two that I picked were extremely helpful for me. Please don't do that. Were extremely helpful for me. And they helped me to learn how to communicate. They helped me to learn how to sort of the seasons of a relationship I'd heard a lot about, I just didn't know. And it explained so many of my attributes or the way I looked at things at that time. And I realized I'm 17 years sober now, and I've really not had a good relationship, and I'm not blaming them. I knew it was me. I didn't know how to do this. And so I put together, based on that information, some different ways of doing things. Because to me, so much of who I am and what I had to offer was not of value. And I think for a lot of gals, they just like, put the whole farm out there, so to speak, without any requirements. I'm sure they'll come, you know, kind of an attitude. And that typically isn't the case. And so I realized for myself that I needed to do things differently. And it began with, I made a decision to have some guidelines. And one of them was, I don't kiss anybody for the first 30 days. Now, when I share that with sponsees, their jaw drops and they go, oh my God. So, hey, let me just say, that was my guideline for me. If you wait 30 minutes and that's longer than you've ever gone, well, by gosh, you've made progress. But the point of it was, is whenever those kinds of things started, so did my fantasy world. And the potential they had, oh man, they got potential. Absolutely. We're born with a lot of it. We don't use much, but there, by God, they got a lot of potential. They're gonna be's, gonna do's, gonna get's. And so I made that decision. And what happened is it started taking some integrity for me. Now, I might have had integrity of other areas of my life, but this is one that really needed more discipline, if you will. And so I, for the next 8 years between marriages, I would date four people. I would, the first two were people not in the program. And for me, I realized, while interesting, it's really, my life is so involved with Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think that a non-alcoholic will understand that level and be totally good with it and understand why I do what I do. And so I knew that that probably wasn't a good plan, but it gave me some new experiences. And then I went 2.5 years without dating anybody, which was absolutely fine. That wasn't a requirement. I never had my biological clock ticking. I didn't ever need have to get married. I didn't need somebody to be validated by on somebody's arms to look good. I'm okay. That never was part of my needs. I'm very independent, and that was fine. And then I dated two people in the program, again, about 6 to 9 months each. And both, again, with that method of that, you know, getting to know them little by little. And one of the things that in the 12 and 12, step 12, it talks about how natural it is. It, you know, it says nearly every sound human being experiences at some time in life a compelling desire to find a mate of the opposite sex or not, with whom the fullest possible union can be made, hyphen, spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical. Now, what's fascinating to me, when I read this a couple years ago, when I was reading this, it just dawned on me, I don't know if that order was intentional, accidental, just words that came to their mind. But in looking at them, if that was really the order we got, and we do it backwards typically. We start with the physical, and then that emotion gets rolling and running, and then maybe we chat with each other. But it takes, if it ever gets to spiritual, it's probably, I mean, it, if you get there, that's great, but most don't even hit that word. And so in starting, this was some of the ways that, you know, who are you? What kind of a person are, how do you handle stress? What's the relationship with your family? How's your work life? You know, these kinds of things that when I get too emotionally ingrained without time running up to that, I don't ask those questions because it's all about me. I'm not learning and finding out about the person. I'm looking about how my needs are going to get met. So having that new change allowed me an opportunity to do things differently. And I was, again, there's a very interesting story that led, you know, you heard Kent's story, what led to New Orleans in April of 2000. I have a different version of what led to that, but the culmination was we were all at my sponsee, Lori, boyfriend, Mike, and meeting Kent for the first time. Now, if you ask us, so you know, a common question to a couple of, so how'd you meet? I think it depends upon who you ask, because we both have different versions of how we met. And it's fine, it's fun. He has his story, I have her story. So anyway, the thing was, is we officially for sure met in New Orleans as the result of being at that conference together. That is kind of what it used to be like and what happened. Now, in the time that we have left, we've got maybe 25 minutes left, but it's, you know, to take us and give it a little Q&A. So do you want to, you want me to continue on?
Or open it up for questions?
No, not. We haven't even talked about our marriage.
Go for it.
Okay. So anyway, here's what happened. I didn't really know Kent when I met him that first weekend.
I knew her.
And he knew me in from various means. No, you don't need to tell all that story because it's too long. And so what happened for me is over the prior 2 years, I had this imaginary wish list. And I just got grandiose. I knew it was never going to happen. So I was just really out there shooting for Mars. And I just wouldn't think about it. In the last 6 months, I mean, when you're 20, your ideals list from the fourth step looks a lot different than when you're 30 and when you're 40 and so forth. They all look a little bit different. And I think I'm about, I don't know, I guess early 40s when I meet Kent. And I'd had 42. And I had this imaginary wish list. You know, active in the program, relationship with God, has a good relationship with their family, but it's not smothering, is steady in his work life, good sense of humor, lots of things like that. But here's the weird of it. The last two things, and I distinctly remember putting them on there, was, gee, wouldn't it be cool if he was like a doctor? You know, a daytime doctor. I mean, I'm not going to ever become a doctor myself. I have no interest in that, much ambition. But wouldn't it be cool if he was like a daytime doctor or something? And he's a dentist. And the other thing was, now this is really kind of freaky. I don't know where this came from, but I said, I'd like him to be a widower. And the reason was because I knew he had stayed to the end and the past relationship had concluded. Now that's a weird, goofy, odd couple of things. And yet, when I would really officially meet Kent and get to know him, all of those things on that Mr. Right wish list were on there and a whole bunch more. So what's strange is that most of the time when you see whirlwind romances, you're kind of wishy, you're kind of, well, let's see. And here was the weird thing. We met Easter weekend, which was in mid-May. Our first date weekend, which included no kissing, he stayed in a hotel, was 6 weeks later, Memorial Day weekend. 6 weeks later, we're at the International Convention in Minneapolis, and we got engaged. Now, I know that sounds strange, sounds a little fast, and yet it didn't surprise anyone. The connection, the energy, the rightness about it. And 7 weeks later, mid-ish August, late August, I moved to Northern California, but only because I had an engagement ring and a wedding date. I wasn't moving until that. I had no intention of living with a man. That's just me. I was not going to play house like that. It was either real or it wasn't. It was either a future or it wasn't. And there were other things about the relationship that I knew was that before we got engaged, when we would make plans, I would put him in ink in my calendar. Now that is very, everybody's in pencil. It's changeable, it's movable, it's cancelable. I put him in pen. And so that was kind of one of those things that kind of sprung up in me and thought. So I move up here and we get married April 14th, 2001. As he said, in 2 months, we'll be 20 years. Shocking, absolutely shocking. Because still after 2 years, I was like, I still like hanging out with this guy. And almost 20 years later, I still feel that way. And there's so many things that have been enriching and close to with each other that I did not know that I could have something long lasting. Now, I know there's people on this call with marriages way longer than ours. This is our personal best. I had one before, he had three before. And this is till death do us part. And I know that there is no back door. We put in our vows, there's no back door, quarterly weekends, date nights. Now, sometimes that's a little hard. This is kind of a date night-ish here tonight in service. And yet our life together, while I am so inspired by him and how he does Alcoholics Anonymous and works with others, it has just been such an add to me. It really for me is one of those things where his assets are my liabilities. I am not good in the things he excels in, and I get to learn from that. And same with me. My assets, those are a bit of a weakness for him. And so this is where I get to be of service to him. So I'm going to, yeah, I'll turn it over to you now for a little chat.
I liked it when she was talking from the podium and she said, well, he's got a lot of little defects.
No. You had the two big ones and I had a lot of little ones.
And it was equal in her mind because they balanced out, is what she said from the podium.
Yeah.
And a few weeks later, after we had come back from Las Vegas and we were driving around, and I said to her, do you remember talking about your defects of character and my defects of character? She said, yeah. I said, well, have you ever heard of the disease of perception? Because, well, anyway. So when we first got together, being the philosopher, the idealist, the pensive, the one who thinks too much, I invited her to participate in a discussion about what do you think are the valuable parts of a relationship? And I'm thinking, you know, soulmates, or how you, you know, enlighten each other and fulfill each other and all that. And no, she's a blonde. You know what she said? She said, I think it's important that we laugh together. And I'm thinking, well, I don't want to say what I was thinking, because she's a blonde and she fits that category. And I just thinking, oh my God, what a shallow way to think about her, right? But I did not say that to her, thank God. But we were 10 years married and we were off on one of our quarterly getaways. And it was one of those times where we were just having a ball and just laughing, our just feeding off of each other. It is kind of fun to have somebody, you know, I can read her mind and I can see what she needs and I can pick out stuff that she would love to have. And so you have that kind of bond that you have with some other human being, but we were also enjoy the kind of humor that we share. And at 10 years, we're laughing that weekend. And I'm thinking, you know, that's a pretty good judge for a relationship. If you're still laughing at 10 years, you probably got a healthy relationship. It's a nice barometer. We still laugh. We still have fun. But I still do follow direction, as you probably noticed when she said a few things that I responded very appropriately. So I believe in that. I believe my role is to give her all the freedom to do whatever it is that she believes in and whatever she wants to do, unless she is off base, unless she's off the chart, absolutely wrong. When she is absolutely wrong on this issue, I feel it's my responsibility to come up with some way to say it to her so she hears what I'm saying. I mean, I might be able to tell her the truth, but you say the truth to most people and they're going to just dig in and defend their position. So my way of communicating those kind of difficult issues is to use humor. And one of the first ones was we were talking about intimacy, right? And so she can just touch the hearts of thousands of people. She can get up in front of a podium and, you know, everybody's going, yeah. You know, just she can do that. Just amazing. But in my case, you know, I'm kind of the guy that likes to get into and down into and depth and so on. And so I said, we were talking about intimacy, and I said, okay, so how do you spell it? And she said, what? I said, intimacy. And she spelled it. I said, oh, good. We're at least we agree on how to spell it. But clearly we're not on the same it's not the same in each of our lives. So those kind of differences can be the places of irritation and problems in relationships. But I can remember one of the first times that Glenn helped introduce me to what to do. There were two things. One was Skeeter and my sister hated each other for whatever reason. I mean, I had it all figured out. And if they would just listen to me, both of them, I mean, I could straighten this out. And Glenn said, stay out of it. Don't say anything to either one of them. I mean, but he did it in such an authoritative way. It was like, don't you dare. And it's like, oh my God, okay. And I didn't. And, but I've watched a lot of people, especially those that I sponsor, they're going to fix so-and-so and make it work. And they get involved in the fight between these two people and they get bloodied, you know, and they never get, it never gets any better. But the other thing was that, we were going to my folks' 60th anniversary in Hawaii, and everybody in the family got invited, and Skeeter didn't want to go because my sister was going, whatever. But I'm ready to tell Skeeter, hey, this is what you got to do as a part of this family. And I didn't say that. I went to Glenn and we talked about it. And for 3 weeks, we talked about it. And finally, when I'm talking to Glenn, I said, you know, I'm the son, I got to go. And Glenn said, well, that's true. I thought, well, so I got to go tell Skeeter that I have to go to the thing in Hawaii. And so I went home and I said to her, you know, as the son, I really need to go. And Skeeter said, yeah. Well, now that wasn't the way I was going to approach it. You see, what I was going to do is I'm going to tell her, we got to go. You're going to have to go. You're going to have to put up with this. You're going to have to, right? But instead she said, sure, go right ahead. And about 6 weeks before we were going, she came to me and she said, do you still put all those credit card miles on your, so you can get free air miles? And I said, yeah. And so she said, well, the room would be free. So I got our ticket. And the point is that it took me 3 weeks to come up with a way to talk to Skeeter about how she could hear what the problem that I could have created. So the same thing with Debbie, I do the same kind of, how do I say it so that it doesn't make it worse, it comes to a conclusion.
I think the other big thing that has made it so enjoyable is applying the traditions. We have had several things to make decisions about that when we put the traditions in place, the bottom line is always respecting the other person's viewpoint. We've had small to very major, massive remodels. And we've had so many couples say to us, and this isn't saying, oh, aren't you so special? That's not it. But we've had couples say to us, oh my God, we almost got a divorce over our remodel. And I've just said, I'm sorry that you had that experience that really hasn't been ours. Not that I've said this to them, because that wasn't necessary, but we've had so much fun and laughter and enjoyment of collaborating on decision-making. And these were some big, big decisions. We have four pets. I have a four pet limit. I've honored that. I've tried to push it a few times, but I haven't. There was a time when there were two cats that looked exactly like the cats we currently have. And I really thought they would be perfect here because they were Coco and Chanel. I mean, what better names to come into the Davis house, right? And I said, they'd look exactly like our cats. Nope. And he walked away and I had a moment of thought, I wonder if he'd notice. Now, I didn't get those two cats. I just want to honor that, but I thought it. But I honored and respected. It's never been, well, hope you like it. This is the way it's going to be. And also I think love is, yes, hearing the words to me are important. they really are. When we end a phone call or depart each other for work or wherever it is, if that might be the last words, and I know many of you couples do that, to tell them I love them is a very important last, that they know that they heard that. But also it's about demonstration. And there's lots of ways that you can demonstrate love. And I think one of them is laughter. One of them is home caring. One of them is listening, paying respect to each other, asking for their thoughts on this topic or get their feedback on something. There's the demonstrations of it. Cards when it's not an obligatory day. Those kinds of things mean a great deal. I mean, when Kent will often go to Costco and bring back my favorite flowers, and it's just a Wednesday. And I love that. He goes walking with a guy, and they end up, and I love different types of greenery. And so he'll whack off a couple things, bring them home. And he knows what I love. He knows what I'm thinking. That's kind of scary sometimes, because he can I think I'm this poker face, and he's doing a readout of my mind. It's which also makes me laugh, that he's oh my God, you're dead on, you know. So there's lots of ways to demonstrate that love too.
Well, I'm not retired, and the reason I'm not retired is because she's mentioned the fact that if I am ever retired, she's going to quit bringing me coffee before I wake up. She gets up an hour before I do, brings the coffee upstairs and sits it on the table on the nightstand right beside me. So when I wake up, I've got coffee. And then, of course, I take a few calls in the morning. And before I get out of bed, she brings me breakfast in bed too. So she's alluded to the fact that if I ever quit working, I might not get that. So I'm still working on figuring out how to retire and still manipulate. I haven't got there yet. We'll work on it though.
2 years before I met Kent, I said to God, because I don't have a college education, barely squeaked out of high school, had to do it by a correspondence course because I was drunk. And so I wasn't going to retire with wealth and all kinds of 401ks. It just wasn't going to be. And my ambition level is about minus one. Okay. I'm not lazy in life, but I have no ambition. I would die from malnutrition if I had to be a salesperson. I am the worst salesperson ever. So I said to God, if you make it possible for me to be supported with me not having to work, I could be a lot more used to you. And I think he said, okay, I dig you up on that. As the result of that, because when I married Kent, it was possible for me to retire, and God has taken me up on my offer. For the last 20 years, I am busier than when I was working. I'm up earlier. I'm to bed later. Because my usefulness, we have both found, has been in the service to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am grateful to do it. I am so glad I have his support to do what I do. Typically, in other conditions, I'm traveling a good bit of the year at conferences or workshops or something. Often he'll go if he can. But what makes me feel really good is not once does he ever have to worry about me and my behavior. I don't ever have to worry about him and his behavior. One of the other things too I want to share is that if I died tomorrow, if Kent went through my phone, my wallet, my purse, my closet, my emails, he would not find any shocking, surprising evidence. He might be bored, but he would not think, oh my God, I did not know this door of her life. I don't know about you, but that makes me feel really good about being a transparent, honest partner in this relationship. I've had friends who've had very unpleasant surprises when their mate died. And that is so important to me, the honesty, the trust, because once that trust is broken, it's never fully repaired. I've had that before. And there's always that, the second something similar comes up, bam, it takes you right back to that muscle memory. I don't care how long ago it was. And so it's really important for me to be that trusting person in this relationship. That is a great deal about love. I don't want to hurt them.
But I think the satisfaction from a good marriage is what makes it possible that she can go through everything of mine and be absolutely not surprised. So I think it comes because of the relationship that we don't have a need because it's fulfilled in what it is. I can honestly say that there have been times in my life when I had a different purpose. Currently, my purpose in life, and I've had a nice little chat with God about this recently. I was asking God, what part of my life? What is it that I'm supposed to be doing? What defines who I am in this era of my life? Well, today, from now to whatever. And it came to me in a word. It was like, oh, that's a perfect description. Wow, that's the word that defines me in this phase of my life. I went to work. I'm trying to think, what was that word? Oh, was it, let's see, helpful servant, participant? What was my, God, I swore I was going to go home at lunch. I worked through lunch. Right after work, I shot home, find out I had to go because I had written the word down, and it said I was, the word that came to me was this part of my life, I was to be a provider. And so what I am is I, by my own definition, is to provide for Debbie. So make it possible for her to feel that security, to know there's no unknowns, to feel comfortable, to be cared for, to be financially secure, to know that she can go and do whatever she does and know that there's a place that she can come. I'm the provider. So it's like, it's a good fit.
Well, that takes us to 6:25. So we'll go ahead, Yvonne, now and open it up for any questions, however you want to do that.
Okay. All right, you guys, if you want to stick your electronic hand in the air, and if you have some feedback you want to give or questions, we can do that. Or let's say thank you first, as you all are thinking. Nadine, I see you. Let's all unmute and just say thank you to Kent and Debbie so we get that out of the way.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.